This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. The United States and China have agreed to get their trade talks back on track. At the close of the G20 summit in Osaka, Japan, U.S. President Donald Trump also said for now there would be no new tariffs against Beijing.
At least the time being, we're not going to be lifting tariffs on China. We won't be adding an additional, tremendous amount of, we have, I guess, $350 billion left, which could be taxed or could be tariffed. And we're not doing that. We're going to work with China on where we left off.
The president traveled next to South Korea, where he wants a handshake meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the DMZ tomorrow. Here's AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
President Donald Trump has told a G20 summit press conference he may be meeting with North Korea's Kim Jong-un on Sunday during a visit to the demilitarized zone with South Korea. But he says nothing has been set up just yet. Trump added Kim has responded to the offer and was very receptive to the idea. North Korea's first vice foreign minister says it's a very interesting suggestion. And the meeting, if realized, he says, would serve as another meaningful occasion. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Asked about his meeting with Saudi Arabia's Prince Mohammed bin Salman, President Trump talked up economic ties while claiming anger over the Saudi killing of dissident journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi.
They've been a terrific ally. They're creating millions of jobs in this country. They're ordering equipment, not only military equipment, but $400 billion worth of, and actually even more than that over a period of time, worth of different things. And with that being said, I'm extremely angry and unhappy about a thing like that taking place.
For more news, you can always go online to voanews.com. There is also a VOA mobile news app. This is VOA News. Trade is getting the headlines, but leaders at the G20 meeting managed to hold the line on climate change since the last summit in Argentina, with 19 countries committing themselves to the Paris Accord, everyone but the United States. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that was encouraging, but British Prime Minister Theresa May is urging greater efforts.
In recent months, we have heard hundreds of thousands of young people urge us, their leaders, to act on climate change before it's too late. I'm proud that the UK has now enshrined in law our world-leading net zero commitment to reduce emissions, and I have called on other countries to raise their ambition and embrace this target.
A former New York City first responder who helped lead the fight for the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund has died. Luis Alvarez was only 53. Here is AP correspondent Julie Walker.
Luis Alvarez responded twice to 9/11, once as a New York police officer who spent 3 months working in the rubble, and then again when he fought for funding for those sickened at Ground Zero. In his final days of battling colorectal cancer, he testified before Congress about the need for permanent funding.
You all said you would never forget. Well, I'm here to make sure that you don't.
His family, in a statement on Facebook, said, "We told him at the end that he had won his battle by the many lives he touched." Julie Walker, New York.
In the wake of heightened tensions with Iran, including the shootdown of an American surveillance drone, an attempt to limit presidential powers to wage war has failed in the U.S. Senate. Here's AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
On this vote, the yeas are 50, the nays are 40. The 60-vote threshold having not been achieved, the amendment is not agreed to.
An amendment to a defense bill that would have required congressional approval before the president can order military action fell 10 votes short in the Senate Friday. Four Republicans joined most Democrats in supporting the failed amendment. The White House and Pentagon had written a letter opposing the amendment. Earlier in the week, President Trump asserted he doesn't need congressional approval to engage militarily with Iran. The House will likely try to attack its own limits on military action against Iran with its defense bill next month. Mike Gracia, Washington.
The captain of a humanitarian ship with 40 migrants aboard has been detained in Italy after the vessel rammed a border police motorboat at the port of Lampedusa. The collision happened as the captain of the Dutch flag Sea Watch steered her rescue vessel toward a dock. The migrants finally stepped onto Italian soil more than 2 weeks after their rescue at sea. Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Salvini had refused to let the refugees disembark until other European Union countries agreed to take them in. Five nations have now done that. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Our main concern is his health. Had he been, he was healthy. We know that he is somebody that he can resist. But our main concern is his health. So we are so worried and we are in pain and we know God will do something.
The Cameroonian main opposition party demands the immediate release of its leader, John Fruindi.
The U.S. has been very supportive on especially the war against terror. They've also been extremely supportive on the humanitarian issues in the northeast of Nigeria in particular, and also with HIV/AIDS.
Nigerian Vice President Yemi Osinbajo says the U.S. provides support to his country's fight against terrorism.
It's not just Malawi. We have examples in this world where results have been overturned and there has been no chaos at all. Actually, the chaos that we are looking at is the false results that were announced.
And the Malawian main opposition leader, Lazarus Chakwera, demands a rerun of the recent presidential election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Cameroonian main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF, has condemned the abduction of its leader, John Fruindi. The SDF is demanding his immediate release and has called on the government to ensure his safe return home to his family. No group has claimed responsibility for his abduction. The opposition leader was abducted following his return from the hospital Friday. He was there for treatment for an undisclosed ailment. Fruindi was discharged and returned home before armed men entered his home and abducted him, wounding one of his aides, shooting him in the leg. For more about his abduction, I reached one of Fruindi's family daughters who witnessed the incident.
Actually, that he was admitted in Bingo Hospital 2 days ago and was discharged. He came to the house at 1:30 or so. I don't know the exact time. So when he came, we're trying to see if we can prepare something for him to eat since we ate just breakfast in the morning. When we finished preparing maybe the lunch and he ate, went to have a rest. Some few minutes ago, we had gunshot in the parlor, that is in the dining table. So we rushed down to actually see what is happening. When one of the boys was shot on the leg, the boy came to greet daddy to ask him how was it in the hospital and how he's faring. So what happened is he resisted the gunmen because they were insisting and asking that tell us where the chairman is. So he was like, I don't know. That is when he was shot. So when the chairman heard the gunshot from his room, he left the room to see what actually is happening. So that is when the boys came and they took him.
Did they say where they are coming from? Some are alleging that they are Amber boys. Others are saying possibly they could be security agents from the government. Did they say which group they belong to?
No, with no communication. The thing is that he was like telling them, the only thing that we heard was he was telling them that where I am from the hospital, I am not where he was. Like they were really dragging him and saying, Mr. Chairman, you know, they were saying that, Papa, if he resists, we will shoot you. That was what happened. And they left the gate, enter into a car. Is it a taxi or what? I don't know how I can describe the car. And they took him away.
So how is the family taking this abduction? Because this is not the first time that they've done this to him by abducting or kidnapping him, as many people have described it.
It's really terrible. We are really feeling bad. The problem is, you know, he was just discharged today from the hospital, so our main concern is his health. Had he been, he was healthy. We know that he is somebody that he can resist. But our main concern is his health. So we are so worried and we are in pain and we know God will do something.
Has the family contacted the authorities, the police perhaps, about his abduction?
You know, the news has been spread and the governor came and asked to confirm because he heard that that is what happened. So he came to confirm and he left the house. He said, okay. Then he came and confirmed it's true. He said, all right, I will get back to you people.
Did he say what he's going to do about it? Did he make any promises?
Nothing. He just said, I came to confirm if it's true, and that was just his words.
How about members of the SDF, since he's a founder, what has been their reaction so far?
Everybody is not happy. At least we have the population is outside, the party members, the well-wishers, the neighbors. The house is full.
That was the family daughter of the Cameroonian main opposition leader, John Fruindi. She spoke with me from Bamenda. Nigerian Vice President Yemi Osinbajo says President Muhammadu Buhari's administration is committed to improving security in spite of criticisms that the administration has been ineffective in protecting life and property. Some opposition groups have called for the firing of all security chiefs, including the chief of the army, following a surge in kidnappings and violence carried out by militant groups. For more on his mission to the U.S., I caught up with the Nigerian Vice President Yemi Osinbajo here in Washington, D.C.
Mr. Vice President, what is your mission here in the United States?
Well, three main things. First, as a guest of the Council on Foreign Relations, talking about Nigeria's economic prospects, and then also meeting with the business investor community, mainly in New York, to look at the investment opportunities in Nigeria and what we could do to make it easier for investors to do business in Nigeria. And today in Washington, I am guest of Vice President Mike Pence, who has very kindly agreed to meet with me to have a discussion on bilateral issues.
So what would you say is the relationship between Abuja and Washington, and how would your government want to see the relationship?
I think it's so far been a very warm relationship. We work very closely together on many of the key areas. The U.S. has been very supportive on especially the war against terror. They've also been extremely supportive on the humanitarian issues in the northeast of Nigeria in particular, and also with HIV/AIDS, you know, with support in for the eradication of HIV/AIDS and treatment of HIV/AIDS. And, you know, so the U.S. government has been extremely supportive. And, of course, you know that our president, President Muhammadu Buhari, was here last year to meet with President Trump, and they had very warm and very useful discussions on a wide range of topics, from the economy to issues in the Sahel, especially concerning terror and all of those kinds of issues, and the kinds of support that we require. So it's been a very good relationship.
So, Mr. Vice President, how do you respond to critics who say your government, despite repeated promises, have yet to improve security in Nigeria?
Well, I think security concerns practically all over the world, you know, just morph in terms of complexity, you know, so you don't have one type of security concern. And for every government, this is an ongoing task. You don't come to a point where you say, we have now resolved the security concerns of our entire country. That's hardly possible, even here in the U.S. and in more advanced economies. I think that what we're seeing is, in many senses, you know, a variety of security concerns. And let me just very quickly explain how that works. So, for example, we have the Fulani herder-type conflicts, you know, which is basically a resource conflict. And this is all over the Sahel. As I'm sure that, as you recognize, we have the same concerns in northern Ghana, the same concerns in Mali, in Ivory Coast, where you find migratory herders who are coming to the south in search of water and pasture, on account of desertification now and various problems. But the problem with these individuals who are migrating is that they are eating from the farms of the farmers. Many of them, and in many cases you find that they are armed, some of them armed because of cattle rustling, which they had experienced in various encounters with cattle rustlers. But also the availability of arms coming from, you know, the abandoned armories in Libya and all of that. So you find that the farmer-herder clashes is one distinct form of security challenges that we have. And we've had that in the North Central, where in Benue and, you know, Benue, Taraba to a certain extent also. But that's a very peculiar type of situation. And essentially it's a resource conflict. Sometimes people want to create the narrative that it's a religious conflict. It isn't so. I mean, because, and the reason why that isn't so is because when you look at Benue, for instance, which has a strong Christian population, and many of the farmers are, of course, Christians. You know, of course, when a herder who is Muslim or animist, Fulani Muslim or animist, attacks a farmer, it could really, you could run the narrative that this is Christian versus Muslim. But anyone who understands this well and who is not trying to be mischievous will understand, first and foremost, it's a resource challenge, and that it has been so for several years. That's one. The second type of challenge we have is, of course, with the you know, Salafist, jihadist, you know, movements all across the place, where, you know, radical Islamic terrorism. Now, these are individuals such as the Boko Haram, ISWAP, you know, you find that now these individuals, you know, are not, they are essentially terrorist organizations that do not have any, their enemies are everybody who does not belong to their sect.
Yemi Osibanjo is the Nigerian vice president. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has promised workers that his administration will ensure swift implementation of the minimum wage. The government and labor groups recently agreed to increase the minimum wage from $50 to $82 per month. The president also called on state government as well as private institutions to implement the minimum wage. This, he says, would form part of the effort to encourage workers to contribute to the country's development. For reaction to the president's call, I reached Dr. Peter Ozo Esong, General Secretary for the Nigerian Labour Congress.
We do believe that the implementation will take place soon, because we have people representing us in a committee that is negotiating the consequential adjustments to the salary table for federal workers. And as of yesterday, the report we have is that progress is being made. And hopefully they will soon conclude that negotiation. Once that is done and the implication for the salary table is determined, then we do expect that the implementation will take place. So we are positively waiting for that development. And the president says so. We believe it is true.
Are you anticipating good faith negotiations? Because previous negotiations have seen accusations and counter-accusations from both labor and the administration.
Well, you know, this negotiation is slightly different from the minimum wage negotiation, which dragged on for a long time. Because now that the minimum wage has been agreed and determined, that it is law, it is the implication, what we call the vertical relativity on the salary table, that adjustments need to be made up. And at least so far, we have no reason to think that negotiation is not in good faith from the reports we get from those representing us. There were issues as to whether the adjustment should just be in terms of quantum figures or percentages. We prefer that it be done in percentages. We are told as of yesterday that that has been agreed. So progress, we do believe, is being made.
So some of your members, I understand, were not impressed with the slow nature of the process. They anticipated that once it's agreed on, the process will be expedited so they could get the minimum wage, because they said the prevailing economic conditions are difficult for them. What do you say to them?
Well, yes, clearly we know that individual workers are anxious, and we are too, that the implementation should take place quickly, because this thing came into law, that's over almost 2 months now, and it needs to be implemented. We are doing all that is within our own control to expedite this process, and we do expect when, at any, if at any stage we discover that there is stalling or there is bad faith, we will also speak out. As of this moment, we do not have such. We believe that things will soon come and implementation will take place soon.
The president called on state government to ensure that the implementation goes through. However, some also expressed concern that some of the state governments are saying that probably they might not have the funds to implement this. Is this a major concern to you or to your members?
Yes. You see, what I am talking of now is for federal workers. As for the state government, each state government needs to carry out its own negotiation on the consequential adjustments on the salary table. And therefore, we are expecting our individual state councils of the Labour Congress to work in their states to do such negotiation. Our anxiety, our worries are more with the state governments, because some of the state governors may be foot dragging. But we stand ready at the national level to come to the support of any state where there is foot dragging. So we will take each state case by case as that develops.
What are you going to tell your members now in anticipation of the conclusion of the process?
We've already told our workers that they should give maximum support to those representing them in the state councils in the negotiation, and show unity and strength so that the state governors will realize that they have to do these things quickly. And where there is need for any action to be taken to drive home this, the national bodies are ready to come to their support.
Dr. Peter Ozoesong is the General Secretary for the Nigerian Labour Congress. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The presidential candidate for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, is demanding a rerun of the presidential vote. Lazarus Chakwera is also legally challenging the outcome of the presidential poll, citing voter irregularities and rigging. The Malawi Electoral Commission declared incumbent President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika winner of the poll. But Chakwera and Mutharika's former Vice President Salos Chilima from the opposition UTM have rejected the outcome of the election. For more on the demand for a rerun of the presidential election, I reach Maurice Munthali, spokesperson for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP.
We have taken note of the fact that were announced depended on papers that we feel were tampered with. And we have no guarantee that wherever those papers are, they are safe and that they are representing the exact vote that people casted on 21st May. So we had to resort to having the whole presidential polls done again because we do not trust that the same people who tampered with the elections would keep those things safe enough for us.
But why will the MCP only focus on the presidential election?
The Malawian law stipulates that a candidate must petition the court or bring his or her case before the court with the evidence of the charges that he or she is presenting before the court. The issues and the result that somebody is accepting. In this particular case, this tripartite election process has, it were, three tiers: presidential, parliamentary, and local government. So Chakwera is contesting, is denying the results, despairing the results of the presidential vote, which means all parliamentarians, if they have cases, they have to do so on individual basis. Likewise, the local government. So you don't have to do it as a whole. You only have to do it case by case. So Chakwera is doing it as a candidate on the presidential poll.
Some are suggesting that the tampering that you talked about, the evidence that you might have, might be too insignificant to affect the outcome of the election, particularly with the presidential vote. Your response to that?
Yes, we have evidence across the 5002 polling centers and in all the 28 districts. And our evidence is overwhelming, and we have all the belief that the evidence is not going to be insignificant. It is going to be overwhelming, and it will prove that the vote was tampered with. And that is where we base our argument.
Is the Malawi Congress Party confident in the independence of the judiciary or the High Court to render judgment in your favor?
We have very, very capable and professional judges in Malawi. And indeed, there are cases where the judiciary might not have acted to the satisfaction of the Malayan people. But on the whole, we have very, very professional and capable judges. So far, and according to the case that is before the High Court now, the judges are doing their job very, very professionally and very independently. And it is our hope and prayer that this trend is going to continue, that they are going to discharge their duties professionally and independently.
Some are suggesting that it will be rather odd for the court to overturn the victory of President Arthur Peter Mutharika, because in overturning the victory, it could plunge Malawi into chaos or possibly violence and destabilization.
We have examples in this world. It's not just Malawi. We have examples in this world where results have been overturned and there has been no chaos at all. Actually, the chaos that we are looking at is the false results that were announced, because that is actually putting Malawi on a very wrong path, because we are breeding a country that is going to be built on lies. We feel that there will be no chaos, and we feel when justice has been seen to prevail, there will be peace in this country, unlike what is happening now, because what has happened and what was announced is the fountain for disorder in this country.
Maurice Muntali is the spokesperson for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. A senior World Health Organization official warns efforts to contain the spread of the deadly Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo will remain elusive unless the vicious cycle of violence in the region is broken. Latest WHO figures put the number of Ebola cases at 2,284, including 1,540 deaths and 637 survivors. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
WHO Assistant Director General for Emergency Response, Ibrahima Sose Fall, says there's been good progress in scaling up operations to contain the spread of the deadly Ebola virus in conflict-ridden North Kivu and Ituri provinces. Fall has just returned from a three-month stint in Butembo, the epicenter of the Ebola epidemic in DR Congo. He says infections are continuing to fall in the major urban areas of Butembo and Katwa, thanks to coverage in all 33 health areas. At the same time, he tells VOA the operation is running into difficulty in the rural areas of Mabalako and Mandima, the new hotspots of the epidemic.
The access is more challenging. And in the same area, we have some villages where you have both ADF, that's the armed group coming from Uganda, and some Maimai groups. So access needs to be assessed on a daily basis to be able to move up to the intervention. So it's really important to take into account this very volatile situation.
Eastern DRC has been politically unstable since 1998. There are an estimated 4.5 million internally displaced people in the country. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says new displacements are occurring mainly in the eastern provinces of Ituri and North and South Kivu. More than 100 armed groups reportedly are engaged in sporadic fighting in the region. Fall says constant and skilled negotiations with the armed groups are needed to gain access to these volatile areas.
The outbreak started there last year and spread to other disease. So it's important to break this vicious cycle to contend very quickly the situation in Mabalako and Mandima, where we have more than 55% of the cases coming from.
Fall says it will be exceedingly difficult to contain the virus if more money is not immediately forthcoming. He says $98 million is needed to support the government-led response to defeat Ebola. To date, he says, less than half that amount has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's ambitious reforms in the country's history seem to be at risk. The murder of his army chief of staff amid an alleged coup attempt in the Amhara region has highlighted the vulnerability of the reform process. Abiy, who has been hailed as a reformer, now faces the problem of nearly 2.5 million people displaced by ethnic violence and deep divisions within the ruling party coalition. Hussein Kiflu is a political commentator and a member of the Ethiopian diaspora. My colleague Douglas Impoga reached him in Dallas, Texas, for a comment on these developments.
I think the main problem is ethnic politics as introduced by TPLF, that is the main faction of the EPRDF, the Tigray People's Liberation Front. And these people has been promoting this narrative that all the problem of Ethiopia in the past came from the Amhara domination, which is not true. They've been marginalizing the people whom they consider as Amharas. Any Ethiopian protesting this ethnic politics in the narrative they were promoting is Amhara chauvinist, and so they were marginalizing people from, especially people from Gondar, the northwestern provinces, Gondar, Gojam, including Shawa, the central part of Ethiopia, and now Abiy Ahmed, the current prime minister, he came from the Oromo faction. The Oromo faction is what they call OPDO, Oromo People's Democratic Organization. There are extremist elements in this Abiy Ahmed's party. And Abiy doesn't want to offend these people. He wants to appease these people. So instead of raining on all ethnic extremists, he went and targeted only what they call the Amhara people in the Amhara region. So that is what created the problem. And on the other hand, the Tigrayans, the Tigrayan regional leaders, the ethnocentrics in Tigray, they defy and they taunt his government, and he doesn't do anything to them. So I don't think this would be very good news to Ethiopia in the very near future.
The Prime Minister Abiy is known for being a reformer and hailed across the continent. He has released political prisoners, appointed women to more than half of his cabinet posts, persuaded a notable dissident to head the country's election board, and staged a historic rapprochement with neighboring Eritrea after decades of conflict. Are all these reforms now, you mean, under risk?
Yes, they are under risk. To me, I've been very critical from the outset. I was not carried away by the euphoria. To me, he was projecting this conflicting image. Yes, he seems to have taken some unprecedented reforms. But at the same time, he was not able to distance himself from the ethnic politics. When he speaks in Amharic, in the official language of Ethiopia, he promotes this narrative about Ethiopian nationalism, Ethiopian patriotism, but then his own constituents, the extreme elements of the Oromo, they are gun-toting, machete welding. They were displacing people in from what they claim to be their region and their region only. And he didn't do anything about this. Yes, he released political prisoners. And now, as you can see, he's imprisoning people again. So, and to me, he was projecting this conflicting image all along. And about the rapprochement with Eritrea, yes, he made a rapprochement with Eritrea. But what did Ethiopia get out of that rapprochement? Now borders are closed, but Isaias Afwerki benefits from that. He was made a pariah by the international community. Now, because of the rapprochement that he made with Abiy, now the international community lifted all that sanction, but Ethiopia cannot even use the port because Isaias Afwerki is still unpredictable. I think everything that has been done is going down the drain, and Ethiopia is at risk again.
Given what you just described, Ethiopia, as we know, is due to hold elections, I think, next year. Should these elections go ahead in the current circumstances?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the field is so mired in too much conflict. There is no due process of the law. People are being jailed, rounded up, and like individuals who have a mind of their own, like Skender Nega, cannot even function. We don't know whether he will be imprisoned tomorrow or the day after tomorrow for the umpteenth time. I'm going to make another prediction here. I don't even think if Burtukan Mideksa, the one who is overseeing election now, if she's a lady that I used to know, I don't think she would even be with Abiy's government. She may even resign. That's my prediction. So I don't think so this election can take place, unless it's going to be another farcical election.
Hussein Kiflu is a political commentator and a member of the Ethiopian diaspora. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Dallas, Texas. African experts are expressing concern that the ongoing tension between the United States and Iran could have a chilling effect on some African countries. This after U.S. warships were deployed to the Persian Gulf in response to reported threat against U.S. forces in Iraq from Iran, and as well as the recent downing of a U.S. surveillance drone. For more on the effects tension between Washington and Tehran could have on Africa, reporter Magbil Yabaro reached Professor Abdi Wahab Sheikh Abdi Samad of the University of Nairobi in Kenya.
From Sudan to Eritrea, and to the north from Somalia to Kenya. That's 2,500 miles, you know, that would be what they call all the maritime issues. So almost 35% total, you know, what they call transportation will go. That's one issue. Secondly, as we are aware right now, Iran is literally, you know, controlling Yemen. So for instance, they are publicly supporting, you know, the Houthi militias. So if the tension is great between Iran and the US there, definitely it will affect the entire region, including the Arabian Gulf.
Right.
For instance, Iran is controlling what they call Iraq, Iran is controlling Syria, Iran is controlling what they call Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iran is controlling the Houthis in Yemen. So whatever, you know, happened, the tension between Iran and the USA, it will affect the wider region, including Horn of Africa or Eastern Africa, and also Gulf of Africa. So it will be a disaster for entire Horn of Africa.
Also, if we want to particularly speak on Djibouti, for instance, right? Because of the strategic location that Djibouti possesses and how it has a U.S. command base there and several other foreign military bases, how do you think Djibouti in particular would be affected?
Definitely, it will affect, because if the tension continues, then the Iranians, they have a lot of proxy forces in Yemen. For instance, the Houthis, they're publicly supporting Iran, no question about that. So that they will target the U.S., you know, bases in Djibouti, because, you know, Djibouti and Yemen is strategically their neighbors. So whatever happened in Yemen, it will happen also in Djibouti as well. So the Houthis will target, specifically will target the U.S. bases in Djibouti. That's how, you know, what you call, you know, the Djibouti will affect the entire tension. Another one is, not only for U.S. bases, also the French bases, and also what you call the China bases as well. So definitely whatever happened today, tension between Iran and the U.S., it will affect Djibouti as well. So that's what I'm saying, you know, precisely what I'm saying is, it can be a blessing and it can be a curse, both ways. It depends on how the rotation escapes.
And lastly, when it comes to the Gulf region throughout its entirety, in the event of a major war in the Gulf, which region would you think would be the most vulnerable?
Definitely, it's what they call the Gulf states. That's Saudi Arabia, you know, UAE, United Arab Emirates, as well as what they call Iraq. It would be the most affected, you know, countries if the tension, you know, became out of hand. Because there is literally today in Iraq is controlled by the Shiites. Shiites, they have a link, you know, an ideological link with Iran. And also, U.S. has a base in Iraq itself. In addition to that, you know, the missiles of the, what you call, people, the Iranian, can easily reach the United Arab Emirates. Just, you know, the two countries are neighbors. So the entire region will be what they call, you know, in disaster, total disaster. So maybe to some extent, the Horn of Africa will be a blessing for them, because all the what they call the ships will go that route.
Abdi Wahab Sheikh Abdi Samad is professor at the University of Nairobi. He spoke with Macbeal Yabro from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Right now it's time for music from our African collection. You are hearing Neji featuring Singe with Carino, Irene Intali and Queen Sheba with Otubatisa, Fik Makfika featuring Paturangin with Omubwati, Aja Sumano with Kokaberi, and then we end with Bunny Mark, My Sweet, My Sugar, Let Me Love You. Si pongo niño caselo, senora senora ando na cuica, popote ulipo e itita, upeke na halindo ni mechoka, maila, uzuri haiba haijanisha, mahaba matamu mimi kukupa, kwangu zambi kuficha, popote ulipo.
Señorita, it's nice to meet ya. Girl, can I know ya? You know that I need ya. You know that I miss ya. Fine boy from Nigeria. Asante sana. Nakupenda wewe. Give me love, make you give me love. Give me touch, baby, give me touch. Baby, please go low for me. Bend down and go low for me. She got me feeling. Up and wind it, bend down for me, go low, mommy, you know, say, back up and wind it, bend down for me, go low, mommy, you know. We'll be right back.
Jaga, njaga 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 romu bwati. Mwana ya gala murasta supasta tomo kuwa njiri toli pasta miwundu kumutima vikube purasta zanja kunze samu wala we divasta kajagala kumaja ajagala personality na uziza kukuja nalambo yoye quality baby for better for worse tulina solidarity love ya tugata to from different society.
Yeah, you make the party that they shout shout love it and you bubble in a your bum shot girl boy I love you man I take gunshot. Man, I take gunshot. She raise a love with a rasta. She raise a love with a rasta. The girl he fell in love with a rasta. She love it clean and fast.
Fresh,
okay.
music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, do not respond to a mosquito with a hammer because you will miss and hurt yourself. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm David Byrd. There's